Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozwodski, and welcome to the show. Last week, Pope Francis released his encyclical on climate change, Laudato Si. The document spoke out strongly against environmental degradation in all forms, and even called for climate justice between the global north and south. My first guest, Elizabeth Stoker Brunig, spoke with me about the Pope's encyclical and how it fits into political and economic debates. Elizabeth is a staff writer at The New Republic and writes frequently on the intersection of religion, politics, and economics. One interesting detail in Laudato Si is a very specific injunction against carbon trading. This market-driven means of trying to fight climate change is, however, still gaining popularity. Just last month, for instance, the Ontario government announced it would sign onto a scheme that now already includes California and Quebec. In my second interview, I thus speak with Romain Felli, a research fellow in politics and the environment at the University of Geneva, who has looked extensively at carbon trading. He offers a critical take on these schemes. Romain joined me from Toronto, where he is on a one-year research exchange at York University. First up, though, my conversation with Elizabeth Brunig about Laudato Si. So, Liz, you've been writing about the Pope's latest encyclical, Laudato Si, and on Catholicism and the Pope in general. This encyclical is broadly on the theme of climate change and ecology, and it seems it's almost more non-Catholics than Catholics who are excited about it, especially amongst political figures in the U.S., and I think we can say in Canada as well, amongst the conservatives here and other forces. Why is that?
Well, I think what's great about Laudato Si is it's an encyclical that's very easy for people to connect to. A lot of them have been like that. But this one, it had a lot of other things going for it that made that more obvious than it has been in the past. One of them was this fantastic rollout. Pope Francis brought a lot of interfaith figures from the Eastern Church and people who are not religious to comment on Laudato Si and contribute to his thinking on it. I think that made it very accessible to a lot of people. And the fact that he was willing to tackle in very frank terms, right, what he sees is, the hugest threat of our day, which is climate change.
What is it about ecology and climate change that can lead to, as you said, probably the most strongest sort of economic criticism to date? Why does this topic, on the one hand, connect so easily with people, on the other hand, connect so easily with a sort of critical stance?
I think that the reason that the Catholic view on climate change leads into the Catholic view on ecology and then directly into the Catholic view on social justice and economic justice is because the fact of climate change from the Catholic perspective has to do with a failure to register the use of resources morally, that we haven't been viewing our use of material creation in a moral way. We've been doing it, through various other, ethical stances that we have been relying on the logic of markets or the logic of profit instead of the sort of moral ecology that's already available to us Catholics. So I think that what Pope Francis did in connecting climate change so clearly to a kind of moral ecology that involves an economic critique is to recover that kind of reasoning that maybe heretofore had been a little bit lost.
Some specific things I know I've seen you write about is that Catholic theology is not traditionally supported, and bad pun here, the sanctity of private property. Is that connected here as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's sort of, it was an interesting paragraph for him to include, but he's very blunt about it and says, the Catholic Church has never traditionally supported the idea that private property is an absolute inviolable right, which means that, endless accumulation, that accumulation without any notion towards the meaning or the use of property has never been something the Catholic Church has been supportive of. It's always critiqued that kind of treatment of material creation. And what Pope Francis is saying there is, yes, property is one of the civil institutions that helps us maintain orderly societies. But the church has always supported the idea of private property insofar as it helps us do that, support societies where everyone can flourish without any respect to whether you are rich or poor. But the way that Pope Francis uses the term, the idolization of markets, or the deification of markets, has led people to turn away from treating property as something with an intended use that should be the regulating factor in its implementation, and has resulted in people treating property as a sort of idol of its own.
And how does this connect with some of the really more concrete arguments? And the one that I found really striking was this sort of injunction against carbon trading, and this idea that, you know, that this is not capable, these market-driven measures are really not capable of dealing with climate change, you know, quite specific, moving from moral ecology to something like this.
Right. Well, Pope Francis references Pope Benedict's Caritas in Veritate, which is another encyclical. It was Benedict's last encyclical. It's a beautiful encyclical. And he footnotes it at a point at which he says, look, markets are not capable on their own without any other kind of regulating moral force of producing justice. And that is because, in my view, people are not capable, operating purely on self-interest or purely on a profit motive, of producing reliably, beneficent outcomes. And this goes back to, you know, moral points in Catholicism that are as sort of standard as original sin, that people are not inclined, when trying to, reach their own ends, to do what is right without guidance from, you know, for instance, the church, without guidance from a morality that puts things in their proper place.
On a more general level, then, you've written that the Pope is, you know, this sounds quite radical, and you've written that the Pope is radical, but not in a way that, to use the U.S. term, liberals might sort of understand this. How is it best to describe and understand this Pope's radicalism?
I think what makes sense, and I think it was Cardinal Wuerl who said this first, in my reading anyway, that radical comes from radix, which refers to the roots, and that Pope Francis' radicalism is not a radicalism of reaching out to a sort of reformation of theology that is, you know, unheard of. His radicalism is a radicalism of reaching back to a form of theology that had not yet been, you know, in many ways kind of misunderstood or distorted. And he's reaching for a theology, and you can see this in Laudato Si very clearly because it references a hymn that was written by St. Francis of Assisi. He reaches for a theology that's very original to the church. And I think it's a mistake to imagine Pope Francis' radicalism to have nothing of the past in it. I think that, you know, quite to the contrary, Pope Francis' radicalism is one of really reaching for the elements of the theology of the past that, have been sort of put aside in the modern
and
world.
What are some of these elements?
Well, one of them is the idea of a moral ecology. I think that I primarily focus on the theology of private property, but I do think it was very gutsy of him to come out and point out in very clear terms, in a condensed way, in a way that reacts to the very long history of Catholic theology, starting with the very earliest writers, St. Augustine, Clement of Alexandria, St. Ambrose, that in fact, private property is an institution that we have control over. It is not, in the kind of, Enlightenment or post-Enlightenment way of thinking, something that comes to us with its own set of controls that we just have to respond to. It's actually an institution that we can shape to meet our needs to a degree. And I think that those things were very well understood in the Middle Ages and before. There were actually huge debates between the Franciscan order and the rest of the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages over the institution of private property and what kind of rights constituted private property and could they be put aside. And Pope Francis is very clear-eyed about all of those theological ideas.
Is there a tension there between a democratic and a more sort of, I don't want to say authoritarian, but, you know, a sort of top-down or bottom-up sort of understanding of how these institutions can be shaped or how they can be sort of superseded, like property? given the history of the church and the way that it has a certain structure to it.
Right. I mean, I think the church has done a very good job of being a supporter of democracy. Certainly the themes that make the church a good supporter of democracy are already present in political writers like Augustine, who talks about, you know, a common weal of the people and so on and so forth. But I mean, obviously the institutions that will shape private property are going to be very different in the Middle Ages than they are now in sort of democratic societies. But I don't see anything in Pope Francis' rendering of that theology that would incline it more towards those kind of old forms of governance than the newer ones.
And on a more practical level, how is it possible? You know, I started asking about those non-Catholics who are excited about this encyclical and the large sort of environmental movement. How is it possible for that, the non-Catholics or radicals, to relate to and connect and sort of support these radical messages within the church?
I mean, I think that's a very good question. I think that one thing that has kind of spooked some Catholic critics of Pope Francis so much is that he does seem to easily draw so many people from outside the church, and the church is sort of used to receiving nothing but criticism from those quarters. So I think it's a good thing that folks who don't identify with the Catholic Church in any way are wondering how to respond to Pope Francis in a way that helps him along. But to that end, I think Pope Francis has established a really good interfaith dialogue. And I think that something I look forward to in response to Laudato Si is seeing other faiths respond or produce their own visions of the kind of moral ecology we'll need to move forward on climate change. Because as Pope Francis repeatedly emphasizes, it's going to take everyone. This isn't something that the Catholic Church alone can make a dent in. It's something that we need the whole of society working toward in order to effect any kind of change that will make the future generations safe. So, I mean, I hope that it results in a good faith, interfaith dialogue.
And is there a way to conduct this dialogue? I think the other part that, you know, is there is also a very sort of holistic look in Catholic in a sort of Catholic worldview. And I know that, you know, there's references to all the other sort of social injunctions for the sanctity of life and anti-abortion and all that. And they're connected in with the climate change messages or teachings or what have you. Is there a way to get, I don't want to say get around that, but, you know, sort of to work within that still in a way that can bring lots of different people together?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about, Catholic moral theology is, and Pope Francis uses the term, a seamless garment. It's all one thing. And the same ideas that make Pope Francis motivated to defend the dignity of workers and the dignity of people who suffer unduly due to climate change motivates him to defend the dignity of the unborn, which I know is a sticking point. There's no way to square the circle and say, okay, well, everything counts but the unborn. Because Catholic theology is very integrated, I think Pope Francis uses the term everything is interconnected, which I thought was a very beautiful turn of phrase. But there are ways that I think, you know, coalitions from different faiths can work on targeted projects. And the Catholic Church has been pretty successful at doing that through the, you know, Catholic Charities and so on.
So there are mechanisms there, and it's not a, you know.
Yeah, I don't think it's like a deal breaker, right? If you don't agree with Pope Francis or the Church on abortion, for the specific issue of climate change.
That was Elizabeth Stoker Brinning of the New Republic, talking about Laudato Si. Next up, my conversation with Romain Feli of the University of Geneva and temporarily York University on carbon trading.
So, Romain, I wanted to interview you because carbon trading schemes are gaining in popularity here in Canada, and you know quite a bit about these sorts of schemes. First, maybe what's a basic definition of carbon trading, specifically the kind of cap and trade systems that some states in the U.S. and provinces in Canada are pursuing?
So the idea behind cap and trade system is that in order to solve pollution problems, you need first to put a maximum amount of pollution that you want to tolerate within a given ecosystem. And this is what we call the cap. And this is generally a political decision, which is informed by experts, scientists, and so on and so forth. But it's a political decision on the maximum amount of pollution that you want to tolerate. And then the question is, how do you distribute the rights to pollute amongst different parties? And here there are different ways to do it. You can give these pollution rights for free, or you can auction them. And then once the industry has these allowances, as they are called, they can use them in order to produce whatever they produce. And if they need more pollution rights because their production process requires more emissions than they have received, they are allowed to buy extra allowances. And on the other hand, if they need less than what they have received, they can sell these rights. And this is the trade part of cap and trade. So it's basically a market mechanism in order to solve pollution problems. First, set a maximum amount and then distribute these rights amongst different industries and let them trade these rights and therefore put a price on pollution.
Right. So the outcome is you have a price and it'll fluctuate depending on how much, you know, if firms think they're going to pollute more, they're going to want to buy up these.
Exactly. And the idea behind that is that in order to reduce pollution, you have to make it more costly for the polluters. And as we live in a society in which, money is a very powerful source of social power, it is thought that by putting a price on pollution, you can somehow help to save nature or save the environment.
Right. So it sounds like you say, you know, money is a strong thing. It sounds quite good. But while only Canada and North America were only sort of starting to ramp up these kinds of schemes, a large scale system has been in place at the European level for almost a decade. What's been the verdict on the European system up to today?
Well, frankly, the European system has not been that great. It was launched in 2005, the so-called European Trading Scheme. And the first period between 2005 and 2008 saw a massive allocation of these emission allowances amongst the heaviest polluters, such as the cement industry or electricity producers, which means that the price which was put on the ton of carbon, so the price that was put on the emission rights, quickly dropped, and it dropped to a level to which there was basically no more economic incentive to reduce pollution because these emission rights were almost free of charge for the polluters. So the first period of the European trading scheme was frankly a disaster in terms of pollution reductions. And since there have been a few corrections which have been added to the system in 2008 and 2012, and now in the third period since 2012, but the fact is that the price of carbon has remained extremely low, around 10 euros a ton, whereas most experts argue that you would need a price at around 30 or 40 euros a ton in order to really bring about a change in the production processes in Europe. So thus far, it has mainly allowed the heaviest polluters and the most polluting industries to escape regulation.
What's really at the root cause of this failure, in your opinion?
Well, I think there are two different issues. One issue is the way in which the different trading schemes have been designed, how they've been implemented, and the experience that we have so far, especially with the European case, is that the heaviest polluters and the industry have had the upper hand in designing these schemes and have therefore created pollution schemes which, frankly, have not had much of an impact on their activities. So we are pretty much in a situation in which the industry that you want to regulate are actually the one who writes the legislation and organize the way in which these schemes function. So this is a more empirical observation. And then there is a second point, a second part of the problem, which is much more fundamental in my opinion, and which is the whole neoliberal idea that in order to save nature, you need to put a price on it, which is at the root of the emission trading schemes, and which informs most sectors of environmental policy today. This is a very strong idea, which in fact is quite new. If you've probably heard that the Pope has released a new encyclical last week on climate change. The Pope, you know, argues against emission trading schemes and more broadly against the whole idea of putting a price on nature. And if you had had this discussion 30 years ago, this would have been a common sense, mainstream opinion. You know, don't put a price on nature. Nature has a value, obviously, but it's an ethical value. It's an aesthetical value. It's not a value that you can transform into a commodity that you can, you know, buy and sell.
TV or a nicer forest, right? A bigger TV or a nicer forest.
Exactly. And the fact is that over these last 30 years, there has been a total shift in environmental policy. And today, the only way in which you can have a mainstream discussion on environmental policy is to argue that you need to put a price on nature in order to save it. Because this notion that it is only through market mechanism, only through money, that you can regulate human behavior has been so deeply anchored in our understanding of society and nature. And this is, I think, the most fundamental problem with the current environmental policies.
Right. So on the one hand, there's an alternative, you know, to do some sort of technocratic tinkering and say, oh, you know, we remove some permits or we change some bits of the system, more cap, less trade. But are there fundamentally sort of different ways to stop environmental degradation and climate change that aren't on this level, which I think, you know, is when you talked about the two sort of levels, the sort of tinkering with the number of permits or something like that would be on the first one. And you'd need something completely different to actually tackle this idea of putting a price on nature.
Well, obviously there are different ways to do it. The first way, and it's almost a joke, but we have to mention it, is basically to say that there is no problem. I mean, this is what the right, the political right in the United States is doing. You know, climate change is a hoax, so don't worry and keep doing what you're doing. But most of those who agree that there is a problem with climate change and with other forms of environmental degradation, because we always talk about climate change, but there are many other, you know, very worrisome tendencies in terms of the global environment and local environments, in terms of biodiversity losses, in terms of, you know, marine pollutions, atmospheric pollutions, and so on and so forth. And obviously, there are those that have been called at various stages ecological modernists or, eco-technocrats. This whole idea that we'll find technocratic or technological solutions to solve our problems is still a very, very important idea. And I think it's still probably the way in which most people would think about these environmental questions. And then, on the other hand, there are the arguments that say, well, what is at stake is not so much the kind of techniques and technology that we use, but really the way in which society is organized in terms of being oriented towards economic growth, restless economic growth, in terms of trying to produce always more, and so on and so forth. So basically the argument there is, well, if we want to discuss environmental questions, environmental problems, we need to discuss not just the environment, but we need to discuss the way in which the economy is organized, whose interests it serves, what kind of human needs it satisfies and which needs it doesn't satisfy, because these are all linked to the way in which our economic systems is degrading the global environment.
Right, so fundamentally something about, more generally about resource use and how we relate to the natural world rather than just sort of, you know, what can we use and to what extent and how much it'll cost us.
Yeah, and basically I think in the end it boils down to the question of what do we need, how do we produce it, how do we express the needs that we have in terms of housing, in terms of transport, in terms of education, and so on and so forth. And currently we live in an economic system in which these needs are expressed through prices. So basically, if you have the money to buy, for instance, education or to buy transport or to buy housing, then you receive it. And if you don't have this money, well, you're
too bad.
Too bad for you. And I think that to some degree, we need to collectively think about other ways of organizing the way in which we produce and we distribute economic goods and services. And this is a fundamental question if we want to really tackle environmental issues.
We only have a couple minutes left, and I want to just sort of take that back sort of full circle to where we started, which is, you know, this rise of carbon trading systems and they're gaining popularity. What's a sort of practical alternative, or what kinds of things are people proposing in Europe where you have this system and it's clearly not working? Is there something that's easy to come to start the conversation, but to move it towards more fundamental questions?
No, it's not easy. And it's not easy because everything is interlinked to some degree. The question in Europe is a bit different because we are already pretty much into these emissions trading systems. In some countries, also linked with carbon taxes and other forms of environmental or climate policies. And there, the question, to some degree, is how can we make sure that schemes are at least implemented in a way in which the environmental and social integrity is preserved, so they are not just cash machines for polluting industry. But on the other hand, I think what I see as important questions which are being raised now in Europe, especially for instance in Germany, is the degree to which states, but here I'm talking especially about local states, municipalities, can organize and produce, you know, basic goods and services, especially electricity. And here I think there is really something which is going on about how can we democratize energy production in a way in which energy production is made for the needs of the population, so, you know, affordable prices and so on and so forth, stable production, but also in a way that integrates ecological constraints. And what you've seen in Germany and other places in Europe is that very important cities have started to re-municipalize, as they call it, to take back into public hand at the local level energy production, also water distribution, and so on and so forth. And here I think there is a movement towards energy democracy at the municipal or the regional level, which I think is a very important lever for climate policy in terms of, you know, electricity production is one of the main source of greenhouse gases emissions. So you better have those under public control than into private hands. And this is one of the things which I think will grow in the coming years.
Yeah, and then you can sort of use that lever to scale up as well, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I come from a city, it's called Lausanne, which is a middle-sized city in Switzerland, in which the city is the owner of electricity production plant. It has therefore been able to implement a lot of energy conservation programs, increasing the output by decreasing greenhouse gases emissions. It has now launched a program to build new wind plants. So, I mean, the fact that you have ownership of energy production allows you to do very concrete transformation of the production, of the way in which you produce something like electricity, which if you relied purely on the market and on private players, you wouldn't be able to do, at least not directly. So rather than, you know, trying to develop too much emission trading schemes or carbon taxes and so on and so forth, I think that public ownership is a more direct way to really bring about change in energy production. And energy is just one sector. There are other sectors, obviously. And I think the left really should think more about this kind of solutions than trying to increase the reach of the market into environmental questions.
That was Romain Feli talking with me about carbon trading and its alternatives. That's all for this week. Talk to you again in 2 weeks.